Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is James Gustaf Gus Speth. Speth is the founder and president of the World Resources Institute and co-founder of the National Resources Defense Council. He is the former dean of the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies and was an environmental advisor for Presidents Carter and Clinton. He is the author of many books, including the award-winning The Bridge at the Edge of the World, Capitalism, the Environment, and Crossing from Crisis to Sustainability. He recently published a fascinating memoir titled Angels by the River, Reflections on Race, Environment, Politics, and Living on the Front Lines of Change. It was published by Chelsea Green Publishers. And I'm speaking to Gus Speth by phone from his home in Vermont. Thank you so much for joining us, Gus Speth. I want to talk about the fact that you were born and raised in a small agricultural community in South Carolina. You grew up in the 40s and 50s. Tell us how this small town informed your activism later in life.
Well, thank you for having me on the program. The little town was Orangeburg, South Carolina, and it's in what's called the Carolina Low Country, getting down towards the coast, inland from Charleston. And it was a thoroughly delightful place to grow up, except for one feature, and that is that we were swaddled in Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. We were deep and mired in Jim Crow and segregation, and it was a nasty, awful system. If you were black. So I had the experience of growing up there in this very segregated little town, and it, in a way, proved to my benefit in an unexpected way. When I went north, as we said, to school at Yale from Orangeburg, I was shaken up quite literally and realized that the ideas of that I had grown up in this sheltered white community about race and segregation were viciously wrong, and so I had this sort of epiphany, if you will, that all the ideas that you've been sort of raised to believe in and the culture that you've been raised in, and it comes crumbling down around you, which has certainly happened to me at Yale, it has a benefit of being liberating. I mean, you're free at that point to decide what you think is right, and decide what you think the right values are, and unsaddled by any kind of inheritance or parental views or community outlook that you may have experienced. And I had that experience, and it sort of started me on a path to think about things for myself which I hope I've done.
You have, and you describe it so well in your book. I mean, we can feel the transition that you went through. Now tell us how you started getting involved in environmental issues. What was the trigger for that? Talk to us about that.
Well, I think there were two things. I mean, one was youth growing up in this very rural community in South Carolina, and we had, as I say in the memoir, I didn't know a bird watcher growing up, but we spent almost all the time in the natural world, in the fields, in the forest, hunting and fishing, and really growing up. And I had this experience of visiting my grandparents up at Lake Junaluska in North Carolina, and went there one summer, and I loved the lake, but came there one summer, and it was totally dead. It had been destroyed by what we think were tannery wastes that had been dumped into this 200-acre lake, and it really shook me up. And I think that was the beginning of an environmental awakening.
And then that was in the early 60s, right?
Well, at that point, I was in junior high, so I hadn't finished. You know, I finished high school in 1960, so this would have been in the mid-50s. And when this happened. But I also had another interesting connection. I think the civil rights movement really motivated us, the group of us who came together to launch what eventually, through some twists and turns, became the Natural Resources Defense Council, one of our leading environmental groups. But we were inspired by the civil rights movement in wanting to do this. We had seen what activism could bring about. We had seen the way that litigation had been used to bring cases before the courts and in the civil rights area. We had seen the legislation in civil rights in 1964 and 65 And we were inspired by that. We were in law school right after those years. And so, you know, it occurred to me one day, well, why don't we form a group like the NAACP Legal Defense Fund for the environment?
It was a brilliant idea, obviously a brilliant idea.
Well, it worked.
It did work, and it's still one of the leading environmental advocacy organizations. But your first focus was on Atomic Energy Commission and the breeder reactors and plutonium recycling programs. Talk to us about that.
Well, we don't hear much about them today, except in a very indirect way, because we were able to, in the end, thanks to President Carter, to push back this idea of launching a new generation of hundreds of new types of nuclear reactors, which would have been more dangerous than the ones that are populating our landscape today.
Mm-hmm.
These breeder reactors,
they're
more risky, and they require the use of plutonium as fuel, and the plutonium, you know, would have moved around. It's very dangerous, toxicity-wise, and also it can be, you know, of course, diverted and made into weapons of various types. And so, you know, with the first litigation we launched that I was involved in, launched at the Natural Resources Defense Council, was to try to force a big public debate on this question of breeder reactors. And we succeeded in that, and mm-hmm. we kept the issue alive for several years. And then when President Carter was elected, basically he killed the program. Mm. And I think if it had been able to plunge it full steam ahead during those years in the early 70s, you know, he might not have had the ability to terminate it, but he in effect did. And it, you know, we were spared this opportunity to have hundreds of breeder reactors across the landscape.
Oh, it's insanity. When you think about that, it's so insane. But so you, after Carter was elected, you joined his administration and became a part of the Council on Environmental Quality. Talk to us a little bit about how that transition was from running your own organization to actually working inside for someone else.
Well, it was very important to me because it was the first time I was actually managing people, which you know, turns out to be something that you're not born with, a skill that you mm-hmm. need to learn usually.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to learn it at the council, but I felt good about it. I felt really good about the years there with Carter and in the White House and what we were able to do for the environment. And the biggest thing that I think we did was to tackle the climate issue.
Yes.
Way back in, you know, 1980,
unbelievable.
In 1979,
yeah.
We were putting out reports calling for action to stem the buildup of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And we knew enough way back then to suggest what the prudent upper bound in the buildup of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere might be. And so we were not, I mean, it was not that this is not a new issue.
Right.
For 34 years, we've known enough to act. And it's one of the, I say in the memoir, this is the greatest dereliction of civic responsibility in the history of the Republic, that we have not acted.
Yep, I was going to mention that you had said that in your book. Aren't you astonished that we have not done anything?
Well, I remain astonished, but even more angry at this point, because mm-hmm. I have my, you know, six delightful grandchildren, and I see the world that we're making for them. I mean, it's a world that's going to be frighteningly different if we don't act in a drastic way now that we've wasted all that time.
Mm-hmm. And, well, the thing that I'm absolutely astonished by is the fact that not only did we not act on it, but we seem to be going backwards. We've got elected officials who are in total denial about climate change.
Well, we had a moment, didn't we, when with an inconvenient truth and mm-hmm. and it winning the Academy Award, and we had in 2008 both Democratic candidates competing with bold plans to deal with the climate issue, and there was a certain feeling of inevitability that we were going to actually do something finally about it. And then we've had nothing but setbacks until very recently on the issue. We have a majority in the Congress of Republicans in both houses who are climate skeptics, climate deniers, hostile to action. And they have the capacity to block any new legislative action. So that's where we are. It's it is. The public has been for some period now coming back in terms of its support for climate action and its realization that this is a real problem, but the Congress hadn't caught up.
Right.
So we're in bad shape. It's tragic in a way when you think about it that the main tool that the president has to deal with this issue now, that he has finally decided to do something about it, is a law that was passed in 1970, mm-hmm. the Clean Air Act.
Exactly. Oh, it's unbelievable. It astonishes me as well. Now, you're also concerned about our consumerism and growth mania culture. So talk to us about that, because the environmental agenda needs to address these challenges as well.
Well, it surely does. Here we have this paradoxical situation in which our environmental groups have gotten stronger and more sophisticated, more capable, bigger budgets, larger memberships, and we find ourselves, 44 years after the first Earth Day, on the cusp of losing the planet.
Mm-hmm.
So something is wrong. I mean, we're not succeeding in the big picture way of saving our environment, and so we have to ask ourselves some hard questions about the current, what we think of as environmental approaches. I put it this way, what's an environmental issue? Well, the answer, of course, is air pollution, water pollution. Those are traditional answers, been around for decades. But what if you answer that question by saying an environmental issue is anything that determines environmental outcomes, that really determines our ability to protect the environment? And when you frame the question that way, then our failing politics becomes an environmental issue. The threat that we have to our democracy becomes an environmental issue. Our consumerism becomes an environmental issue.
Mm-hmm.
There's tremendous inequality in our society, with half the population, families just getting by paycheck to paycheck. That's a tremendous inhibition to environmental action. And so we have all these things that are not part of the traditional environmental agenda that are really the things that affect whether we are able to succeed or not, mm-hmm. for our children and grandchildren. So I think that we need to redefine environmentalism, and environmentalists need to find a way to address these larger issues.
Yeah, I don't understand, because it does feel like the populace is coming around. People are writing about this issue from all walks of life, but there doesn't seem to be the political will. I don't understand the disconnect between the people electing people who are in denial and the people seeming wanting some movement on this issue. I don't get it.
Well, it is hard to get, and there's no easy answer. I mean, it's hard to make this issue paramount in a country where there's so much economic insecurity, and the opposition points out that it's going to raise prices, it will cost jobs. I mean, look at the arguments for the Keystone Pipeline right now, this really terrible idea.
Yeah, exactly.
The big argument for it is jobs, and we need to create good jobs. We really do, but there are better ways to do it. And I think that, plus there's been a huge disinformation campaign. The science historians like Naomi Oreskes have written books now about the way that a doubt about the reality of the climate situation has been, the sowing these seeds of doubt has been a big enterprise for those who are ideologically driven to want to, because they know that if we acknowledge the reality of the climate issue, it's going to take effective, strong government action. And they're against regulation. They're against any kind of taxes on carbon, against government generally. So I think that's played into it as well. And then there's just these powerful economic interests that our big fossil fuel companies, their leaders are they work in the real world. They know science and technology. So you have to assume they know this problem. They're not in denial like some people are.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Gus Speth. We're talking about his memoir, Angels by the River, Reflections on Race, Environment, Politics, and Living on the Front Lines of Change. Now, I want to bring up the fact that in 2011, you are actually proud of the fact that you got arrested protesting the Keystone Pipeline. Did you see more of that kind of activism in your future?
Well, I'd gladly do it again, and I was pleased to march Subsequently, for example, in the with 400,000 other people in New York City to call for climate action. We spent 3 days in the central cell block of the D.C. jail for our sins.
Mm-hmm.
It was important, I think, and it launched this campaign in a way against the pipeline and called a lot of attention to it. So we feel like it, you know, I feel like, and I know Bill McKibben and others feel like it was something we would do again in a heartbeat. One lasting impression I have, which relates to what happened in Ferguson with the grand jury, was that, you know, when we were in the central cell block of the D.C. jail and in leg irons in these large holding cells in the District of Columbia, we saw hundreds, literally, of young black men going through this so-called criminal justice system and sort of trapped in it. And we knew that the door was would open probably, you know, any day, and it did, and we would walk out.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't. And I think it that stuck with me in a big way.
Oh, I bet it did. You know, here in the Finger Lakes, one of the big environmental issues is, of course, is fracking. And there's a huge movement against fracking. Have you done any anything on that issue in regard to your...
Well, I think the fracking issue is part of, from the climate point of view, which I know is not the immediate concern of a lot of people who are impacted locally. But from a climate point of view, it just means that we're digging ourselves deeper and deeper into the fossil grave.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the in the march that we had in New York City with the 400,000 people that came together, a lot of those people were there because of fracking. It was the people across the whole spectrum of fossil fuel insults had joined with the climate activists to protest. And I think this coming together of many causes, whether it's mountaintop removal or fracking or drilling off of Alaska or coal ash in North Carolina, come together with the climate issue. And that's mm-hmm. our strength, is this fusion of people who are affected and people who are concerned about what this fossil fuel industry is doing to us.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you say to people who say, "But we need to be independent. We need to have fuel. We have to have these resources." How do you talk to people about that?
Well, we certainly need energy. There's no doubt about that. It's also still true that we are a gas guzzling, energy guzzling nation
mm-hmm.
That could. Tighten up our whole energy use process from, extraction to final combustion or whatever, final use, and achieve tremendous, energy productivity gains with that. It's also true that, we're seeing a boom in renewable energy,
mm-hmm.
Both wind and solar. I'm looking out into my yard as we speak, and I'm looking at my solar photovoltaic unit out there, which provides about two-thirds of our electricity need here. And, it could be done on an individual basis, on a community basis, on a large utility basis. We're seeing a huge growth, and the prices are way down. You know, in our region, you're up in a northern area, and so am I. There are technological opportunities that are opening up every day. One of them is using heat pumps for our heating needs, and they now have them that work at very, very low temperatures,
mm-hmm.
Like we have in the winter. And so in Vermont, the state is going to subsidize the installation of these air source heat pumps.
Mm. Yeah, there are so many things people could be doing. We need more education. And Gus, how do you make sure that people don't lose hope? Because these issues are so all-consuming and they don't really affect people directly at this moment. How do you get people motivated without feeling hopeless?
Well, I think young people are motivated because they sense that that my generation has left them with a huge problem, and people who, you know, a familiarity with what's going on are deeply concerned about what the world they're headed into. So I think people are motivated by both love and fear. They want something for their families. They want a better, they want a safe and secure and a benevolent place for their children and grandchildren, and they also fear what might be coming if we don't act. So I think we need a positive vision. We need to spend a lot more time trying to envision the world that we would like to see, and putting some real texture, some real context on a future that we can go out and fight for. We need a sense that we know how to get there. We have policies, that ideas that really deal deeply with the changes that we need. Mm-hmm. And we need to seed the future into our communities today. And that's probably the greatest thing that's happening in our country today, is people taking initiative at the community level.
Mm-hmm.
In effect,
mm-hmm.
sort of bringing the future that into the present. And when we have crises, and we will, people will look around and they'll say, well, look, this, they were dealing with this issue in this community, and seeing is believing.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you put that package together and you have some good leadership in our politics, we could begin to see real change.
Mm-hmm. Toward the end of your book, you do talk about the hope, because we do see more sustainable communities, organic food systems, community investment into communities. So there is hope, and there is movement. We have a lot of that going on here in the Finger Lakes as well.
Well, that's wonderful. And we do, too, in the little state of Vermont. It's really reassuring, and it will spread.
Mm-hmm.
It is spreading.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of new types of corporations that are being created, social enterprises, public-private hybrids, profit, not-for-profit hybrids, co-ops, local bank revitalization. We need to have state banks everywhere, all the states. I think that, if we could move our money into our local communities, get a divestment movement out of fossil fuel going in all of our communities and personally, I mean, we could get these things could, once launched, the hope that I have is that the moment will come when they will all begin to come together, that these many causes and concerns and activities will come to be seen as one movement, mm-hmm. one possibility to create the kind of place that we would be delighted to leave to our children and grandchildren.
Mm-hmm. Instead of just pockets, it would be an all-encompassing movement. Do you would encourage people to get involved with grassroots organizations as well as in electoral politics, trying to elect environmental candidates?
Well, I certainly would. Both. I think they go together.
Mm-hmm.
We need to begin to build a decent politics, and it's going to have to start locally. But the environmentalists who have tended not to get involved in electoral politics and not to get involved in political reform that we need so badly, for election reform, for example, finance reform, environmentalists have got to get into the fray. Compare what the environmentalists do, and I think of myself as one, with the Tea Party.
Mm.
Whatever you think of the Tea Party, they certainly knew how to get involved in politics.
Right.
And who, make themselves visible and forceful in the political context. And I think we need that kind of spirit we can make this democracy work, but only if we really get into the thick of it. That's what environmental people are going to have to do.
Mm-hmm. And your book was just published. And I assume you're on tour with this. Are you hoping that your book and you're going around talking to people and being on radio stations like this is going to help motivate people?
Well, I think I wrote the three somewhat academic books with the Yale University Press, and they were for a general audience. But I think a lot of people, you know, find it easier and more interesting and to you know, take these issues up if they are readers, you know, through memoirs and people's own personal reflections and stories. And I happen to be lucky enough to, you know, to be part of some things that turned out to be important. And I think by telling those stories and then asking, well, you know, where did they go? What happened in the end to the environmental enthusiasm of the 1970 and things like that? I do hope I can reach a new audience beyond those who got who read my other books.
Mm-hmm. What was it like writing this memoir? Did you come up with any surprising memories or anything that you had forgotten about your life?
Well, it was fun. I recommend it. I didn't know what I was going to do with it when I actually started, in terms of a readership or even a publisher. So it was a good experience to sort of reflect, you know, to be reflective about one's own life. But I think, you know, a big realization for me was the way that that the sort of civil rights issues that were part of my life growing up had been so important in framing what we did later with the environmental issues. Mm-hmm. And then I think it was also important to me to see the tremendous role that the people that I worked with and lived with had in making, you know, whatever I was able to do possible. I mean, it's just a treasure trove of colleagues and friends and family that you really, when you begin to reflect on life as I did, it really gets down to other people. You know, we're carried forward by other people. Mm. And that's the real meaning of everything, I think, is our relationships. And so this came home, you know, strongly to me in writing the book.
Well, Gus, we're almost out of time. Can you give some contact information, a website?
Well, the book is by Chelsea Green Publishers, and they have it's on their website, Chelsea Green Publishers. But I have also a website for the book, which is angelsbytheriver.com.
Great.
And there's a lot of information there, and I hope people will check it out.
Well, Gus Speth, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for writing this book and all the work you've been doing. Again, the book is called Angels by the River. Gus Speth, thank you so much and good luck. Thank you for all you've done.
Well, thank you for having me on the program.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.